Hello and welcome to your Inside and Out Leadership Podcast with certified coach, leadership expert and qualified teacher Muriel Kosofsky. This podcast provides leadership tips, education, insights, stories and mind hacks to create a space for leaders to self-educate, develop their career and fulfill their potential. I will use my coaching skills, leadership expertise, as well as my guests' wisdom and experience to promote a diverse, inclusive, anti-racist, and sustainable leadership culture, which I believe is the key to effective leadership in 2021 and beyond. And remember, the work we do on the inside will always show on the outside. Now relax, sit back, and enjoy your journey.
So we are on the podcast Inside and Out Leadership. Welcome everybody, and I am welcoming a very special guest, and it's your second appearance on the podcast. So Chisa Miller is with me today as the guest, but I want to say almost as the co-host, because it's gonna be a conversation between us two. So welcome Chisa, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So today we are celebrating Black History Month, and this is really the main topic, I suppose, of this podcast, and what we want to kind of bring about today is having so I suppose there's two sides to the episode today. The first part is having a conversation around race, around racial relations. So obviously I am a white lady and my guest today is a Black lady, so we just want to bring up those uncomfortable questions and just be very honest and maybe just discuss the different viewpoints that we can have as people of different color, I suppose, and how we experience that, and how we want to relate to each other, and the challenges that might come up for us, and just have that very honest conversation. And then in the second part, we are going to dive into Black History Month a little bit deeper, in terms of talking a little bit about literature and about leadership of the Black, the Black people that we want to celebrate today. So that's going to be kind of the second part of the discussion. So did I forget anything, Chisa? Does that summarize what we want to do?
Yes, absolutely.
Please feel free to chip in at any moment if you feel that I'm going off track or I forget something. So great. So we're going to start with just by having a conversation, and I've prepared a bunch of questions, and I know that you also have questions. And I suppose, so I just want to, just as the backdrop of this part of the conversation. So I was telling Chisa the other day that I've watched on YouTube a series called Uncomfortable Conversation with a Black Man, and the host of this series is Emmanuel Acho, who is, I believe, on the American football team, for one of the teams for Texas anyway, and he brings into the show white people, and he's just having this very honest and at times very uncomfortable conversations around race and around racial relations. And I said to Chisa, this would be just such a great thing for us to do, and me as a white lady welcoming you as a Black lady on the podcast, and just do the kind of the same thing. So that's kind of the backdrop. Right, so let's just dive in. I'm just going to pick a question and let's just dive in. So can you tell me about a time where you've been the most uncomfortable around a white person, and tell me what happened?
So I always like to kind of start these uncomfortable conversations, if you will, with a little bit of background, because I think context matters, right?
Thank you.
And you know, in my experience of having these conversations, I always remind myself that, you know, all behavior is purposeful, right? It's kind of like psychology 101. You know, we think the way we think for a reason. We engage in the behaviors that we engage in for a reason. So my background, my father was born in Jamaica. My mother was born in Japan. My mom is half Black, half Japanese. So we're, me and my siblings are first generation American. And I say that to say that in a lot of the conversations that I've had, there is a big difference between someone who's first generation American versus someone whose roots are here in America, right? And so a lot of my history is, you know, Jamaican history and even, you know, Japanese, you know, history. And of course, American history too. But I also grew up in New Jersey, you know, on the East Coast, but up north. And so I have found over the years that my experience has been very, very different, you know, as a Jersey girl growing up versus, you know, a friend of mine who is from Louisiana. You know, so big, very different experiences. So for me, I wouldn't say that I'm uncomfortable around white people because I've always been the only Black one. So I am so comfortable being the only Black one because it's what has always been the case for me. But here's what I notice as I think about this question. There is a big part of me who's constantly, I notice it the moment I walk into a room. I mean, I am looking for other Black people, just like, hopefully there's somebody
that's telling me. Where's my buddy?
And I can see them from across the room and just kind of be like, okay, you know, give them the little head nod. And then there's that other part of me that's constantly asking myself, how am I showing up? It's like this self-conscious, is my hair too curly? Is it too big? You know, how am I coming across? You know, I don't want to come across as too Black. It's just all of these things that go through your mind, which is it's really unfortunate, you know, but it's my truth anyway. You know, I can't speak for everyone. But something else that comes to mind when you ask this question, you know, what's the most uncomfortable I felt around a white person? I had the opportunity years ago to have a conversation with someone who was in the KKK. And it was super eye-opening. It was somebody that a mutual friend of mine linked me up with. And I sought out this conversation because I just wanted to talk to someone. Yeah. You know? Kind of see, and I was so curious, like, how would they respond to me, and are they going to be, you know, rude and disrespectful, or like, what was this going to be like? And I had so many preconceived notions going into it of what they were going to look like, what they were going to wear, you know, how, what their demeanor was going to be. And I just remember leaving that conversation not feeling uncomfortable at all. I mean, I went in knowing that this person grew up in a space that taught him things that obviously I don't believe in, you know, but I was very curious to hear what his perspective was. But I think what was the most uncomfortable part of it was that he was just the average white male. I mean, he was, you know, the white males that I've worked for, supervisors, managers, you know, directors, VPs. I mean, he was just the neighbor that you wave to when you're walking your dog. I mean, and I think that wasn't what I was expecting. I was literally expecting somebody to walk in the room with like a sheet over his head.
Yeah.
You know, and that wasn't it. He was like the everyday, you know, white guy. And I think that was the most uncomfortable thing for me because my perception was that he was going to be one way. And when he wasn't, it was just like, now I'm looking at everybody around me like, wait, hold on a second. Like, you know, and so that was probably the most, the conversation was very comfortable, but the fact that it was so comfortable is what made me feel most uncomfortable because it made me think like, gosh, how many people do I interact with every day who might have those very same thoughts and feelings, you know? So that was uncomfortable. I would love to ask you though. I mean, have you ever you know, I often hear a lot of white people say, well, I'm not usually the minority. So I'm just wondering, like, have you ever been in a situation where you have been the minority in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah. So what comes up for me when you ask me this question? So the answer is yes, it has happened. So, and I think it might be, I don't know if it's the experience, again, it's the context. I don't know if it's experience that most people have or most white people have. So back when I was working in education, I worked in a lot of schools in London, in the inner city of London. And my students at the time in this particular school were, I want to say, in the classroom, I was often the only white person. Not necessarily just with Black people, but also with students of other, you know, what we call ethnic minorities, which is the term I don't really like. But, you know, I had, you know, people from kind of Asian backgrounds and African background or Afro-Caribbean background or, you know, Asian background. So lots of different, you know, backgrounds. And I was talking about it sometimes with, you know, with my partner or with my friends, and I was saying, you know, this is my work, this is what I do. I'm the only white person in the room, or maybe there might be a couple of other students who are white, but I'm definitely a minority. And I think for me, and again, you know, I think you were right when you were saying, you know, context matters. I come from a family where, you know, I was born in France, I grew up in France. My dad is Slovak, from Slovakia. My mom is half Russian and half French. And already this kind of melting pot at the very beginning kind of opened my eyes to, you know, different cultures. And you know, there is a diversity in my family straight away. So it's all kind of white, but it's very diverse within the white. And there's lots of different shades, if that makes sense, within white people, as much as there are shades, you know, within Black people, I suppose. And so for me, I've always actively, probably because of my background and how diverse it is, I've always sought other cultures. I've always wanted to understand what it's like to be different than me, if that makes sense. Yeah. And that's really what, you know, drove me to study Afro-American literature in university. I told you I did my master thesis on Toni Morrison, on one of her books, and really I dive deep in the, you know, in the history of the South and the whole kind of history period around that and slavery and all of that. And then later on in my career, I moved to Morocco. So I lived for 4 years in Morocco, which is, you know, completely different from France and Europe. It's a Muslim country. And again, it was yet another layer, you know, of difference, but I was super curious. So to go back to your question, I found myself in that environment, and you know, I think that it really allowed me to understand, and particularly with the students who were Black and who were of kind of African and Afro-Caribbean origin, because they're all British citizens. That's the thing. Sometimes we think, oh, but no, they're all British citizens. They all were born, you know, in Britain. So same as, you know, everybody else. And you know, for me, it really allowed me also to understand. I think I gained a layer of understanding with those students, particularly around how they felt about white people and how they made me at times understand very clearly that I was white and they were Black, and that there was a barrier there, that they, to some extent, it was difficult for them to extend their trust to me because there was this, they were cautious, you know. Ooh. And then I had to work with that, and I had to work on that, and we had to work together, you know, to improve that trust and to really build that relationship. But I think in this particular school, with those particular students, I really understood the depth of the problem and the gap between you know, the different races, and you know, how, and really, it really allowed me to understand, and really just to understand how Black people have carried this baggage around. And some, I mean, again, I'm generalizing, but just, yeah, that trust. I think that is really the idea. That you know, oh, you know, she's white. Not sure I can trust her, type thing. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but yeah. So I have found myself in that situation, and
oh yeah.
And I think that this is actually a really good question, because I think that white people, and again, when I say white people, Black people, I'm generalizing again. You know, this is all about context, but I think that white people perhaps don't think about this enough. Don't think about this, like, for most of us white people, it's like day to day. Okay, well, I'm never in a minority, am I? Most of the time, it's just, you know. So yeah, I think this is a great question, actually, and I would love for more white people to find themselves in even just to, as an experience, one day, just to find themselves in an environment where they're not the majority.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that was a long answer to a short question. But yeah, and it's great to hear also, to go back to your point around, that. And actually, when you said that, I was really like, oh my God, you know, that everyday person that you speak to could be a neighbor, could be your, you know, whatever. And yeah, they're just like, I want to say they look normal. I mean, it might not be a great way to phrase it, but you know, you would, no, because if you don't have that conversation with that guy, you would never know, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's and something that because when we talked about it, I told him, I said, you know, I was not expecting, you know, clean cut, you know, nice looking white guy, you know, and he was like, you know, there are people like me who are CEOs of businesses, who are, you know, your neighbor. I mean, they're, you know, and this is years ago. And when everything happened, you know, when everything was going crazy last year, that was one of the first things I thought about, because I was just like, I feel like we started to kind of see it. I mean, it was your everyday, it was your neighbors, it was your coworkers. I mean, people who I never thought would think certain ways did. And you know, I attempt to practice, I call it hitting my pause button, but you know, it's okay. I would be a hypocrite to say, you know, as a practitioner of inclusion, particularly, I'd be a hypocrite to say it's you know, you're a bad person, or you're not okay if you think differently than me. So I embrace the fact that you think differently than I do. but you know, we have to be careful that we don't get to the place where we cross the line. And I think saw a lot of line crossing in our behaviors, and sometimes in our behaviors, and even in our judgments of the thing, and a lot of the things that we saw, you know, in 2020. Mm-hmm. So it's eye opening. It's disheartening, you know, but you know, I attempt to focus on the fact that, you know what, I can't even say that he's a bad person. Like I walked away from that feeling like just really confused, because I'm like, he's not a bad person. I mean, we laughed, you know, I mean, we had just a really great conversation. He just comes from something very different than me. And he was fully willing to admit, you know, a lot of my thoughts are learned. It was learned behavior. And yeah, you know, he was in his 40s at the time. And he said, because I learned so much of this at such a young age, as I got older, I either stayed with a lot of the people that I grew up with, or I met people from people that I grew up with. So my circle expanded, but still remained the same, you know, at its core. So it was really cool. And I mean, even at the end of our conversation, for him to sit down and have that open of a conversation with a Black girl, you know, for him, he was like, this conversation will shift a lot of my thinking, you know, just in having this conversation. And that's why I just love conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not enough. It's not going to solve the world's problems, but holy cow, it's a start, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's a start, so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I also love what you said about the circle thing, where, you know, you are in a circle and then you meet people who kind of belong to that same circle. And I think that it's just something that grabbed my attention, because when it comes to diversity, inclusion, when it comes to broadening your experience of a variety of people, that can be a real game changer if you make a deliberate effort to reach out to people who are different than you, who to kind of travel with this intention of really going into the culture and spending time with local people. I'm not talking about the five-star hotel, you know, by the beach. I'm talking about, you know, hanging out with people locally and really, really, you know, trying to understand. So yeah, so it's something that also resonated with me in terms of truly understanding other cultures and other ways of thinking.
Yeah. And you know, I say our circle is our comfort zone. And so we have to challenge ourselves to step out of our comfort zone. You know, I've had, you know, just in my teachings, I've had a lot of people who will say, for example, I was actually when I was in London teaching a class, and there was one of the gentlemen, we were talking about the LGBTQ plus, you know, community, and he was very anti, you know, LGBTQ plus. And what he did was he ended up forcing himself, like very intentionally forcing himself to volunteer at an LGBTQ community center, where he got to know and build relationships with these teenagers, learning from them, hearing their stories, I mean, connecting with them, you know, heart to heart, and that how it completely shifted his thinking, right? So, I mean, we could be afraid of things, we can want to stay away from things, but when we're bold enough to step out of our comfort zone, that's when the learning and the, you know, the growth really occurs.
Completely. And you know, and I remember when I first moved to Morocco, in the first 6 months, it really was an adjustment for me. I mean, blonde girl, blue eyes, they don't see a lot of that over there. So, you know, when you show up, they're like, oh, everybody's looking at you and some people follow you. And, you know, obviously at the time I didn't know Arabic, so they're all kind of conversing in that language. And, you know, I was so uncomfortable for a few months, very uncomfortable. And then after that, I kind of got used to it and I started, you know, making ties and bonding with the community there and learning the language and all of that. And then I went past that discomfort, but it was a huge, huge jump into the discomfort pool, like big time. But it was the best decision I've ever made in my life, to be fair. And yeah, I think I would not be who I am today without this experience. So yeah, I agree with you completely on the discomfort. So I'd like to move on to another question, which is quite a tricky question, and I wanted to have your view on that. And I think what triggered this question is that, because obviously I'm a white person and, you know, I kind of work in the diversity, inclusion and belonging space, and I'm really pro racial equity and anti-racist. And, you know, I like to let the world know where I stand, because I don't want to be, I want to be active with that. I think, I really think that it's not enough to say, oh yeah, no, you know, I'm against racism. I think we have to make that claim. But on the other hand, I've been told a few times that, you know, who was I to talk about anti-racism? Who was I to, that I was almost like overstepping my boundaries because I am a white person and I don't know what it means to be black because I'm not black. So I've had that comment told to me, and I even like questioned, you know, what I'm doing with this podcast and the conversations I've had and the efforts, you know, I'm making to help out, you know, and so I wanted to have your view on, you know, what do you think is my responsibility as a white person in the racial equity space? And perhaps, so what is your responsibility as a black person? So do you have any thoughts on that?
This is a challenging question. So I would start to answer this question just by saying that I have questioned even a lot, particularly in the last year or so, because even in my conversations with other Black people, we as in Black people are at very different places of this road of D&I and racial equality and all of that. I come from my whole, you know, racial equality journey, if you will. The foundation of it started in a space of inclusion. So I tend to view it through that lens. What that means to me is that there is a space for Black people, you know, Native Americans, Asians, I mean, everything to include white males and white people, right? Because I just feel like we are doing a disservice to exclude when we're attempting to move forward, right? I mean, we were, as a Black people, we were excluded for so long, still to this day. And yet I hear Black people say, you know, well, I'm not worried about white people, and, you know, they this and they that. So that challenges me and my feelings and my thought processes, you know, when I hear that mentality. You know, there's a principle that we often talk about, and it's, you do not have to be one of to stand with. I don't have to look like you, come from the same background as you, believe in the same things you believe in, have the same shared history as you, in order for me to stand with you when I know that you're being treated unfairly. So to me, that is, be it Black, white, Asian, whatever it is, as human beings, we should prepare ourselves to be willing to stand with people who are different than us, right? If you just take the United States and you look back through American history, the civil rights movement wouldn't have been what it was without white people who were willing to stand and fight and get beaten up right beside us. If it was just us, we would not be where we were today, right? And that's just one example. And truth be told, as much as we don't know about our own Black history, we also don't teach in schools the white people who stood with us and fought those battles with us, right? So, I mean, that was something that was even brought to my attention that I never really thought about. And it might've been like in my college years, but I thought, wow, that's true. Like, but you don't, I never saw that in the textbooks, you know, I didn't, you know, you just don't think about it when it's not presented to you. So I say those things because I am just a firm believer, particularly as a Black woman, knowing what struggles Black people have had, women have had, how dare I turn around and, you know, segregate or discriminate against anyone else, really. So what is the responsibility? I, you know, often challenge people to practice ally skills. Now, I think when we say, you know, be an ally or I am an ally, I think that can be mistaken sometimes, right? Like as a Black woman, I can say, you know, you're an ally, right? But I can't call myself an ally for the LGBTQ community because that's for them to tell me that I am, right? It's not for me to self-proclaim and wave my flag, you know? So that, I think we're very careful with that, right? But I challenge people to demonstrate ally skills. So I don't have to necessarily call myself an ally, but here's what I can tell you. I sure as heck am willing to stand with you if you need me to stand with you, you know, or if I know something's going wrong, right? So I think all of us should be able to practice our ally skills. How can I stand with, you know, a Black coworker of mine who I know is being treated unfairly? How can I stand with my Black people when George Floyd happens? I mean, you talk about, I think one of the most beautiful things to look at when George Floyd happened was all of the white people in France who were protesting in those streets because you killed a Black man in America. I mean, to me, that was beautiful. I mean, just to think about it just gives me chills. In China, in India, they were standing with us even from a distance. They were protesting and marching in their streets the same way, you know, that we were. So we all have a responsibility to do that, right? Practice our ally skills, to stand with people who are different than us. In doing so, I would challenge, you know, white people to be a little bold and to use your voice because we know that, you know, typically white people have a bigger voice than the minorities, right? So I think that I know a lot of white people who know the right thing to do. They just haven't quite found the courage to speak up, right? Whether they're unsure of what the minorities will say or unsure of how they will be treated by other white people. And I'm sure it's probably a little bit of both, right? But I always challenge people to use their voice. And with that, understand that you will make mistakes. You will make mistakes. You will piss some people off. And that's okay, because when we do that, we get to learn, right? And I think the biggest learning that I guess I would say white people should really understand is that a white person may stand up and say something that I'm like, oh yes, you go girl, like good for you for speaking up. And somebody sitting next to me who's also Black will be like, uh-uh, no, she didn't. Yeah. I mean, you can't please everyone. You know, you can't, because all Black people don't think the same, right? Just like all white people don't think the same. So you're gonna make mistakes. Have the courage to make the mistakes, right? And then seek to understand, you know, how come it was completely okay for you, for me to say that, but not okay for you when I said that, right? So use your voice. Two is educate. Read books. I mean, there's so many, just turn on Netflix and you have a whole like Black stories category. I mean, look at movies. I mean, do whatever you can to educate yourself. And with the education piece, I always say, you know, make sure however you're educating yourself, that you're educating yourself from credible sources. Right? I mean, that's important. step out of your typical box, if you will, of information, because, you know, social media will give us the information that speaks to our comfort zone. They're not very good at all of exposing us to things outside of our comfort zone, right? And then the last thing that I would probably say is, you know, advocate through actions. Anybody can grab a megaphone and yell and shout and scream, you know, here's what we should do, here's what we should do, you know, let's do this. But actually do it, actually engage in the actions, like to the point where you don't even have to say it, take action, right? That is like huge, huge, huge. And I don't mean, it doesn't have to be violent or with anger. You know, I always say there's so many opportunities for us to teach with grace. You know, the same way that you would want to teach your children to do what is right based on what they see mom and dad doing is the same way that we should conduct ourselves in the workplace, in our communities. How are our actions influencing the people around us? Like, I want people to look at me and be like, like what she just did was really cool. Whether it's like, she just made somebody smile or, you know, like, and I may not even know that I'm influencing that person, but they've taken it in, they're thinking about it, you know? I mean, that's the best way for us to advocate for others, right? It's through our actions. If you're going to be bold, you're going to be courageous, do it in your actions, you know, speaking up, all of that. I mean, it's what we do really in our actions. So using your voice, educating yourself, and, you know, advocating through our actions are probably the main things that I would
say. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that. No, it's great. And I love the ally skill piece and the kind of joins up with the kind of taking action, really. Because as you said, you know, I think it's, you know, you can write a post and say, oh yeah, racism is bad or whatever, but that's just not, that's not a skill, or that's not an action, really. This is really interesting. And it's almost, for me, there's this idea of kind of ownership of the ideas that you want to stand by, or, you know, you want to stand by or behind those ideas. And I think taking action is a form of ownership of bringing to life those ideas that you have in your head. So the idea in your head might be, I want to be inclusive of Black people, and therefore you're going to stand by a colleague who is going through a tough time, or you know, you're going to use your voice, maybe in the form of, you know, however you can, you know. For me, I've got a podcast, so I use the podcast to do that. And I'm thinking about, you know, kind of using collaborations, and I'm using, you know, everywhere I can, you know, to kind of put things into, you know, into life, you know, giving life to the ideas that I wanna defend, that I wanna advocate. Almost. So
yeah. I mean, there's so many ways to do that there, and I don't know that there's a specific, like, you know, I mean, there's just so many things, whether you want to support Black businesses, or, you know, create a space where we're giving a voice to you know, minority groups, or, I mean, there's just so many ways. And somebody said this on a panel discussion that I was on, and she said, you know what I tell people, she said, do what you do, period. Do what you do. Like, if that means moving your money to a Black bank, or donating, and you don't have to post it on Facebook or like shout it out to the masses what you did, just know that you're making your contribution in whatever way. For some people that might be marching, you know, and doing things like that. And for others, it might just be donating. I mean, do what you do and be okay with what you're doing, right? Mm. I mean, that's like the best space that we can be in.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's the best way to take that responsibility.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Let's move on to, oh yeah. So this question, I don't think I phrased it the best way. And I thought about a way to phrase it differently. So, okay, I'm gonna say the original question, and then I'm gonna tell you what my thoughts around rephrasing it. So the original question is what can I do as a white person to help Black people recover from what my ancestors have done? So just to give a bit of context to that question, and then I'll talk about the rephrasing. This for me, this is really a sticky point. This is probably, so here we're in the space of responsibility. I think this is the stickiest point for me as a white person. I don't feel individually, I am not my ancestors, right? So I have not made that choice to put Black people on a boat and sell them. I haven't made the choice to segregate, to have segregation laws. I haven't, you know, I have not personally, individually made those choices. However, I feel collectively responsible. I feel historically responsible. I feel that because I'm white, I am in some way a little bit out of my control. I am impersonating that history. I'm impersonating those decisions that were made by people, by other white people before me. So, and I think for me, this is really a sticky point because I feel very strongly about that. I really feel the weight of that responsibility. And that's why I think that's why that's what's driving me. I really want to make things better, you know. I really want to almost like make up for it. And I know that's impossible. And, you know, I don't know. I this is really where my sticky point is. So in terms of Black people recovering from what my ancestors have done, the way I was thinking about rephrasing it is more like, you know, will there ever be a day where, you know, and again, as you said, you know, there's different people will respond differently. Black people will respond differently from one person to another. But is there ever going to be a day where a Black person looks at a white person without those thoughts that you were saying at the start, you know, is my hair too curly or is my skin too black or blah, whatever, you know, is that day ever going to come, you know? And I don't think it will come in my lifetime, but yeah. So what are your thoughts on that? Sorry, that was a long intro.
I think it was really cool just to hear you say that, you know, you feel responsible and own it. I think that a lot of Black people don't hear that enough. You know, what we hear is, well, I didn't do it, so get over it. And that is like piercing, right? And so, you know, if I were to rephrase the question, it would be something more along the lines of, you know, how do you forgive the unforgivable and repair the unrepairable, right? I mean, how do you do that? And, you know, I think, you know, when I really think about it, I think that particularly with, you know, American history, I think a white person can treat slavery as historical and have a curiosity, you know, about it, which is great, right? Because I'm all about, you know, being curious. That's how we learn. But to Black Americans, it's, you know, a cruel, unavoidable, you know, ghost that kind of haunts this nation, the cities, the schools, the hospitals, the prisons. I mean, this is where we get into the systematic. You know, I remember growing up and our parents would talk to us about, because we did grow up in white, you know, neighborhoods, and they would want to give us a heads up about how the community could potentially perceive us, just as a heads up, like just be aware that people might look at you a certain way, right? Now, my parents are baby boomers. They grew up in the 60s. When we grew up, we didn't, you know, as a kid, I knew that I was the only Black person, or, you know, my siblings, we knew we were the only Black people, but it was okay. Like, we didn't feel treated, you know, differently or anything like that. And it wasn't until we got a little bit older, like my parents now say, see, we were trying to tell you. You guys kept saying, oh, that was old, and that happened a long time ago, and it's not like that anymore. So, you know, when you think about our communities, our school systems, and the disparities there, the health disparities, our prison systems, and the statistics in regards to, you know, Black people and jail, the new Jim Crow, I mean, all of these things, it really is. It's heartbreaking to even think, for me as a Black person, to think that there was a time in my life, even though I was young, but there was a time in my life where I didn't think this was a problem. And it's very clear that it is a problem. And I think it's clear to most people that it is a problem. So so how do white people help us recover? I think my knee-jerk answer to that would be, you know, obviously, there's overwhelming numbers of white people in government, politics, you know, hospital, at those high level school systems, use your voice. I mean, I think the only way that things are really going to be able to change, you know, I like to talk about, oh, we need to engage in conversation. But when we're talking about like change, like really get to that place of equity, we really have to look at, you know, all of these things, the hospitals, the schools, you know, our communities, how the school systems, that's one thing that just fires me up, because it almost like brings me to tears to think about all the things I learned in school that wasn't true. Mm. Oh my gosh, everything I learned, I shouldn't say everything, but there was so much that was actually taught to me that wasn't true. Now, do I think my teacher taught me that on purpose? No, my teacher was taught that too, but just how many generations of people were just kind of brainwashed from the truth? Christopher Columbus, and what a great person he was. Well, that was true, you know? So there's so many areas. I mean, in our school systems, our hospitals, you know, what are we doing about our prisons and even our law enforcement, you know, law structure? And these things are so much bigger than me. So I couldn't tell you where to start, you know, but I can tell you that we clearly have some issues. Mm-hmm. And in order for those issues to be changed or even dealt with, there needs to be more representation at that level from minorities, because they're either more likely to get the conversation started, or they can also become, you know, an ally, if you will, or whatever, mm-hmm. to the white people who are willing to engage in that conversation and fight those battles, you know, because they're battles. They are battles. They are going to be wars. Will they be resolved in my lifetime? Probably not. In my son's lifetime? Probably not. But I don't want to see a resolution necessarily right now. I don't know that that's feasible. Like, is it even possible to see, like, mm-hmm. full resolution? Probably not. But I want to see progress. I want to see progress before I leave this earth. I want there to be progress for my sons, you know? And I believe there will be. I think with every generation, I don't think we've come as far as we maybe should have, but I definitely think that we've come a long way, you know? Yeah. You listen to that Martin Luther King Jr. speech, we've come a long way. Do we still have a heck of a long way to go? Absolutely. But we have definitely come a long way. And I think with every generation, I mean, these young kids, these Gen Zs, oh, they are not having it. Like, you know, they're already 12 and 13 writing letters to politicians. And,
yeah.
I mean, they are doing stuff that I surely didn't do, you know,
yeah.
in young days. So,
yeah.
And that's a really cool thing to see, you know, it's a really, really cool thing to see. So, you know, I think if we just keep talking about it and we, you know, there's a lot of great documentaries like, you know, 13th and just eye-opening things where when you watch it and you're just like, wow, didn't realize how real this is and what the impact, you know, potentially is. But I feel like, you know, when white people, this goes into the education part, when the white people, you know, watch things like that or read the books where they're getting educated, you know, there's nothing stopping people from just getting together and saying, what can we do? Who do we know? You know, what are the small triumphs that we actually do have control over that eventually could potentially lead to bigger battles being won and, you know, things like that. So, yeah, I mean, we could talk about this all day.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the be a voice part is huge again, because, yeah. you know, coming from a minority, coming from a Black person, it's just like, you know, but to hear a white person, it almost piques everyone's, you know, interest a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. for some to hear a white person be passionate about change, you know, big change. I mean, that's what we need, you know? Mm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's this next question, and I think it's a really important question. And that's a question about biases. So in leadership, in the leadership space, when I train, we do talk about biases. And this is a question that actually, I didn't make that question. It came up on that show that I was talking about earlier. And it's Matthew McConaughey, who I'm a big fan of, not just because he's handsome, but also because he's an advocate of, you know, that whole kind of racial equity, you know, in that space. And he does a lot for that. So his question was, what bias might I have, which I don't know I have? And I think that this question really resonated with me, because I tend to think that I'm doing pretty well on the awareness front, in terms of me being aware of, you know, of the history piece, and, you know, having traveled and lived in different countries with different cultures. And but I still think that there might be biases I have, which I don't know I have. And so I don't know if you've got kind of ideas around that. Just to kind of help. Yeah, just to help, like, shed light on that, on those biases that white people might have that they don't know they have. And also, I want to say that perhaps it works the other way as well, that perhaps Black people also have developed, fair enough, biases towards, you know, white people, which sometimes might not be justified. So, you know, when I remember, I mean, I told you, when I was working in education, I mean, I've been called racist a few times when I was working in education, called racist by people of color a few times. And every time it was like a stab. You can imagine that, you know, a little bit more about me, about kind of my history. And it was like, ah, me of all people. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I don't know. It's them. There might be something I've done, something I've said, or, you know, so, but maybe it wasn't justified also. So, yeah, what in terms of racial equity, what might be a bias that people might have that they don't know they have?
There is a great quote, and I can't think of who says it right now, but I believe it was a female, and she said, if you have a brain, you have a bias. And
right, yes. So,
you know, all of us do. And I think in any form, anytime you are unable to walk in the shoes of someone else, you can very easily have a bias. It's easy for me as a Black woman to say that for you as a white woman, you can't possibly understand, you know, certain things that I've gone through. But that's a very easy judgment to make without knowing the context, which is what we started this conversation with, right? I mean, you may not know what it's like to be a Black woman. However, I suspect there are some things that we share and commonalities that we share, right? And so I think every single person has biases that they don't even know that they have, right? Those unconscious biases, you just don't know until you're thrust into a circumstance, and the only way you will realize that it's a bias that you may have had is if you're paying enough attention to your response, right? I mean, if you're present enough to say, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe I thought that, or I can't believe I said that, or I can't believe I did that, you won't even notice it, right? And a lot of times that's exactly what happens. We don't notice it. We're in our comfort zone. Nobody checks us on it. And so we continue to do it, right? So, I mean, I guess it's like the easy answer, but I think whether it's, you know, overweight, too skinny, or, you know, the stereotypes that we have about people who are tall versus short, or, you know, there's just so many things that we have these biases about that we don't always, you know, even notice. So, I think when it comes to race, and again, this goes back to like conversation and even just listening sessions and listening to other people's experiences. I think when we listen to other people's experiences, those the aha moments, those moments where we say to ourselves, oh my goodness, like I can't even imagine. It's those moments that create the light bulb for us, you know, those paradigm shifts where we start to realize, if we think back, oh man, I might have said something really insensitive, or, you know, I might have done something that I shouldn't have done. So, you know, it's everybody. All of us have biases that we don't know. And that's why, you know, I like to put a big emphasis on creating environments, you know, psychologically safe environments, where if I say, like something I'm always working on, when I'm, especially when I'm in the classroom and I might have 30 people and we're doing like team building exercise, I'll say, okay, guys, come on, you know, guys, come on, guys. And it's something that I'm consciously, it's just such a habit, you know, but I'm consciously trying to stop. So I'll tell the entire class, listen, here's what I'm doing. I'm trying to stop saying it. So every time I say it, hold me accountable, right? And I'll tell them very honestly, listen, I know I'm going to say it a couple of times, but hold me accountable, because in a few classes, I'll stop saying it. So creating environments where we can call people out and just say, hey, you know, that comment, you know, I know you, so I know that you probably didn't mean it this way, but it could have come across this way, right? Just to pay attention to it. And that doesn't have to be like boss to employee. This is like team members. Can we hold each other accountable? And not in a reprimand and scold kind of way, but hey, you know, when you said something, this is how it kind of rubbed me. And, you know, I just kind of want to talk to you about it. How great an opportunity for us to learn when we create environments where we can hold each other accountable and kind of check each other, you know? So the biases that we may not know we have are endless, I guess, to answer your question, right? It's endless for all of us. But the question is, can we create safe environments where we can hold each other accountable, you know, check each other and learn, so that we might be able to better look ourselves in the mirror and say, this might be an area that I need to focus on. And really, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as you were talking, an idea popped into my head, and it's probably a crazy idea, but wouldn't it be great if everybody was buddied up with a person of a different race, and they just had to be buddies for a year or something? Like, I would be buddied up with you as a white person and you're a black person, or do you know what I mean? And then you would just have to have those conversations every month and just hang out and learn from each other. That would be a great system.
And you know what is cool about it? I would actually expand that, because I can only give you one perspective, right?
Yeah, sure.
The more we hang out and the more of my other friends you get to, because I am no different than everybody else, right? The majority of my closest friends look like me. It's my comfort zone, right? We all do that. But the more of my friends that you got to know and heard their experiences, that's what, you know, there's a great YouTube video. And again, I can't remember her name, but it talks about the danger of a single story. Mm. And, you know, it's our perception of, okay, like, I know this black person now. And so everybody who's
black. Yeah, everybody's, yeah.
You know, and that is, yeah, the biggest misconception. And even as a black woman, the more black people I have engaged in conversations with, I realize, holy, we are all over the daggone map. Like, we think so many different things. Like, something that would totally make somebody else angry won't necessarily make me angry. And so this whole thing of diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, is so multi-layered and so complicated, right? And it's just a continuous journey of life. I mean, it really is. But I mean, I agree. I mean, there are some people and places, you know, even today, where I have people come to class in our classes and say, listen, I grew up with all white people. We didn't have one minority in my schools. I still live there. And, you know, I know one, you know, black person, and they happen to work in my office, but, you know, that's it. And And that's the only perspective of a minority that they have, you know? So the beautiful thing about technology today is that podcasts and, you know, webinars, and there's just, we have a lot of resources to expand our learning and understanding, you know, should we choose to take those steps to get that education. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And yeah, and that, I think that was really the spirit of this idea, was to, you know, take people out of their kind of usual. So for the people who don't really mix up that much, you know, kind of to kind of, you know, you then you have to speak with this person every month, and then just, because it works the other way as well. I do have a friend who, so this friend lives in Brixton, who is an area of London that is kind of predominantly Afro-Caribbean. And this person, I'm their only white friend. I'm the only white person they know. And sometimes I do things and you know, they would say, oh, is that how white people do things? You know, and it's all meant, you know, it's not.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, they don't know anybody white. They have no idea apart from me. So I think also sometimes it works, it could work the other way around, where expanding awareness might, you know, might help with understanding, you know, that you know, that also, you know, expanding that knowledge and awareness of other cultures and other races as well.
Absolutely.
So
great flip of a switch when people realize, okay, like, the more people I talk to, the more I realize everybody is an individual. Everybody, you know, is human. We have some shared experiences, but we have very different perspectives oftentimes.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of diversity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think we've got time for one more question. And now I'd like us to dive into the more the kind of Black History Month type conversation. So thank you so much for the first part of the conversation. I think there's been a lot of really, really cool kind of insights, and just a lot of honesty as well, and sharing of, you know, how we feel and how we see things and how we would like to see, you know, progress. Is that you said earlier, we're looking for progress first and foremost. So yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about Black History Month, and maybe for you to talk about one Black author. So it could be kind of a literature or even like a Black leader that really inspired you, just for us to talk a little bit about the contribution, I suppose, into, because I think that's what Black History Month is also about, is to highlight the contribution, the contributions of Black people, you know, in society. Any favorites?
The first thing that comes to mind are like your classics, right? I mean, like the Langston Hughes and the jazz poetry, which is something that I was turned on to early in high school. And I just kind of fell in love with it. It kind of put me into that whole poetry realm, which I love. Toni Morrison, you talked about earlier today, you know, The Bluest Eyes and Beloved. I mean, those were just amazing book. And again, I mean, these are authors and books that I learned about through education, you know, through school, which was really, you know, eye-opening. We dissected these books and it was just beautiful. And for me to be the only Black girl in the room to know that I'm reading work from another Black woman or just from a Black man, was, it just felt different, you know. It was really cool. Zora Neale Hurston, you know, Their Eyes Were Watching God, that was another one. So those are probably my first, I refer to them as the classic that I got to dissect through school. And I mean, there have just been so many, particularly as of late. I mean, there's just so many great authors, great books on race and you know, Black women in the workplace and, you know, all kinds of things. You know, Michelle Obama, her book, you know, I loved because it was so raw and so real. And she talked about marriage and she talked about
trying to have children. And she was talking about things that we don't talk about a lot, you know, in society, just period. So I would hate, you know, sometimes when I think about diversity and inclusion, I feel like we are at risk of losing the history. Particularly the younger the generations get, it's kind of like, we're going to create this history, and we kind of forget about, you know, what the foundation, you know, the giants whose shoulders we stand upon, right? So it's the Langston Hughes, you know, the Hughes and the Zora Neale Hurstons and Baldwin. I mean, there's just so many that I would talk about, but I hope that particularly for the young generations that our school systems continue to dissect these books in school, because it forces kids, you know, to have this piece of learning that they can then choose to continue, you know, to learn and grow more with those Black authors. So, I mean, there's tons, but those would be probably the first three that come to my mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Michelle Obama was one that came up for me also when I was thinking about our conversation. But for me, Toni Morrison, she's the one I know best, first of all. Langston Hughes have studied at university, but Toni Morrison, and I think for me, she stands out. So when I did my master thesis, so I don't know if you've read that book from her, it's called Paradise. Mm-hmm. And she published it a little bit later, so it came after Beloved. Mm-hmm. And when I studied this book, I studied the how she built her characters in the book. And where I think she's really, really, really strong is that I studied the literary techniques that she used to build the characters. And obviously, Toni Morrison's characters are all holding some kind of trauma, right? From slavery, from obviously she's in a more contemporary setting, but all of her characters carry the baggage of trauma, of segregation, of slavery, of all the things that Black people have gone through, you know, over the years and over the centuries. And she also has a depiction of female characters, which is slightly different from the male characters, and you know, the literary techniques that she used build up characters. And the word that for me that stands out with her is the fragmentation, is that all those characters are marginalized and are dysfunctional in some kind of way. But their story and their history is very fragmented. They can't quite build their individuality and their life because of the fragmentation that comes from that suffering, that trauma, that, you know, baggage that they are carrying around with them. And they end up being completely dysfunctional in their relationships, even to one another within the Black community, which is really, really interesting. You know, those kinds of dysfunctional behaviors, harmful behavior, self-harm, and all of these kinds of things that and I think she was the best at, she is the best at depicting that trauma through her characters and through how she builds her novels and how, you know, how she builds her characters and that sense of that fragmentation, that identity that people can't build, they can't build themselves because there's just too much trauma, it's just too much, you know, and they can't, they're overwhelmed, they can't get over it. So I think through her, and I loved her style because when you open a Toni Morrison novel, you're thrown in. I don't know if you remember the ones you've read, but it's just like, boom, you know, you're right in the middle of the action and she just throws you into, if it was a movie, she just throws you into a scene like straight away and it's bam and just something like it's an explosion of emotions and, you know, all kinds of things happening. And she's also very good at how she organizes time. And I think that really illustrated the fragmentation that I'm trying to describe is you start the novel in a place and then you go into the past and then you go into the future and then you come back. And so you have really have that sense of displacement, of not belonging anywhere. I really think she's, for me, in terms of writing novels, so which is different from poetry, she's the master. I mean, she really, I don't know. And I think because I, going back to that sense of responsibility that I had even at the time, and I'm talking, this was 20 years ago, you know, when I did my master thesis, and I already had that sense of responsibility at the time. And so it's probably why I went so deep into her work, you know.
And I think, you know, just the way you broke it down, that I think that's why it's so important in a educational setting. It's easy. You can pick up the book and read it and be thrown into it, but to really dissect every piece and every character and the why behind the actions, it's another creative and beautiful way to walk in someone else's shoes, right? I mean, it's like To Kill a Mockingbird and Atticus Finch. I mean, he's the one that said, you know, until you can walk around in someone else's skin, then we'll never truly understand. And so, you know, in our education systems, you know, do we have great teachers who are willing to break these things down so that no matter who you are, no matter what your background is, when you're reading these historical Black, you know, pieces, that really understanding the mindset behind the writer and, you know, the message that they wanted to convey.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she is great.
She's great. And I think I'm going to go and reread some of her stuff. I think I'm just going to order the whole collection again and go back. But yeah, no, I think she's great. She's a great example. You know, if and as much for Black people to especially the young, you know, the youngsters to kind of revisit their legacy and their history. And it's not always going to be pleasant, because let's face it, her work is like, it's deep, like it's very intense. It's not, you know, rainbows and daisies, far from it. But also for, you know, white people wanting to, or even other races, you know, wanting to have a better understanding of not only just the history, but the impact. And I think that's also where I got so hooked on her work, is describing the impact that has on the psyche of a whole race. You know, we're talking about on a big scale, like everyone's affected in such a deep way. And I think it's great also for people who want to have a better understanding of not just the history, but the aftermath of that, like when you start picking up the pieces, you know, what do you find?
Absolutely. And I think it's something that we've heard a lot more recently about, you know, trauma and, you know, racial trauma and where we're at and how we can start to move past that. We haven't heard a whole lot about that spoken publicly anyway. And then you think back to these books and you're like, oh my gosh, we've been talking about this for a long time, but we haven't really delved into that conversation, right? So it's there for us. The education is there for us. We just have to be willing to, you know, dig into it.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we're coming to the end of our conversation. We're coming to the end of our time today. So I really want to thank you so much for taking the time and for being willing to engage in that conversation. And I know that conversating is your thing. But yeah, I just want to thank you for that. And yeah, it's been a great conversation. Even for me, it's been a really great experience. And and I think an opportunity to also express, you know, how I feel and you know, being honest in that space in terms of, you know, where I am on my journey and, you know, how I'm feeling with this whole kind of racial equity piece. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I mean, I feel like we could have like 10 more of these.
Yeah, probably. We will probably have more. Okay.
I hope you have enjoyed listening to the Inside and Out Leadership Podcast with Muriel. Please leave your comments, thoughts, and questions via LinkedIn. Look for the self-coaching circle. There's only one. If you are a leader and would like to feature on the podcast, please get in touch too. See you next time.